Hey, welcome to Jazz United. This is Nate Chenin, editorial director at WBGO.
And this is Greg Bryant, host of Jazz After Hours on WBGO.
Jazz United is a show about music. It's a show about the conversation around the music. And it's a show about what Greg and I are digging. And we're doing something a little different this week because we wanted to toss the mic to our friend and partner, Simon Rentner, who has his own podcast at WBGO, a long-running show called The Checkout.
The OG. That's right. That's right. He did an episode that we really dig that we want to share with you about bassist Pino Palladino and producer Blake Mills and their new record, Notes with Attachments. Here's Simon and The Checkout.
Welcome to The Checkout. It's a podcast you can subscribe to on wherever you get your podcasts. All of our shows hosted on our homepage at checkoutjazz.org and produced at WBGO 88.3 FM in Newark. I'm Simon Rentner. If a musician could ever get a medal for having immaculate taste, maybe that award should go to Pino Palladino. A fretless electric bassist, songwriter, and studio assassin playing behind our biggest stars. But he's really much more than that too. He's the definer of a sound on his instrument and has stayed remarkably relevant for more than four decades. And joining him, Blake Mills, composer, guitarist, producer, also has a dizzying array of credits to his name: Norah Jones, Bob Dylan, Wolf Peck, Andrew Bird, Moses Sumney. Welcome, guys. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing this recording, Notes with Attachments. Very understated and apropos, I feel.
Yeah, and such an understated year, you know.
What is this record? I mean, a lot of kind of words come to mind, like, you know, is this orchestral hip hop? Is this a broken beat new music? Is it a beat tape? Is it a score for a short animated film? You know, what I hear is really, it is a pandemic project. Two artists falling in love with their craft.
Well, that's beautiful, absolutely. The majority of the work on this record was done before the pandemic, but you're absolutely right. I think I speak for Blake too. We are both in love with what we do and just so grateful to be able to express it through a record like this.
I believe this is said or stated anywhere on the actual press release for this thing, but so maybe I'm not really supposed to say it, but Pino, is this your debut recording as a leader with you at the helm?
Yeah, it is. It is the first official record with my name on it. Yeah, absolutely, as the sort of artist along with Blake on this record. So yeah, it's been a while coming, Simon, but got there in the end.
Well, that's just like massive kind of news, right? This is kind of like an unusual moment in your trajectory.
It totally is. Absolutely, man. And from the day the first song came out, actually, I think, you know, I joke with my wife that a switch clicked and now I'm going to be a real artist and a Devo, you know, and everything's going to change.
Why don't you take us back to that moment in John Legend's recording 2016, and Blake, just take us to that moment when you decided, like, yeah, let's make Pino Palladino a leader.
You know, it was slightly more a gradual process than that. That's where I met Blake. Blake had reached out to myself and Chris Dave about collaborating on the John Legend record, Darkness and Light, I believe the title was. She's never been afraid of sirens. You know, from the first day in the studio, I really got a buzz out of, you know, the interaction between Blake and myself and Chris and the other musicians in the room, Blake was just throwing all sorts of ideas and unusual ways to get to different results in the music, and I really had a blast with it and just thought, wow, you know, we gotta work together more. So as time went on and we got to know each other a little bit better, the question arose about a solo record. You know, Blake was saying, have you ever thought about a solo record? And of course I had. But, you know, I'd never found a way to translate what I do for other artists into a solo record, because it's not about, you know, a virtuoso performance or a bass line that grabs too much attention or any of that stuff. So it was a conundrum for me, how to, you know, what sort of record I wanted to make and what I wanted to express in that record. And over a period of time with Blake, it really started to take shape, and it was all about the for me, the writing and you know, the sonic, the definition of the songs through the sounds that we had at Sound City, and Blake's interaction with me, bringing his knowledge of recording techniques and going, you know, and trying lots of experimental ideas.
So let's just get straight to the opening, the opus, I feel like. Everything that sounds right with just wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's a soundscape, isn't it? It's a wonderful soundscape you can just disappear into.
Just Wrong, it has, you know, all these different parts. Larry Goldings, I believe, is on organ, and you have a viola, not by Andrew Bird on this particular song, but by another string player. I feel like you had to maybe rent a museum of instruments to even create this record. Like, how many sound elements are just in this specific piece of music, would you say?
Right. Well, that song, in the process of making this record with Pino, that song was the first tune that we got to work on after I had come into acquisition of the studio that we have been working out of for the last 3 years primarily, which is Sound City Studios in LA. Myself and my partner Tony Berg have been leasing the building since 2018 or so, and so when we got into that building, it was a chance to sort of finally have a place where our collection of instruments that we had built over the course of our entire lives could all be out and, you know, within arm's reach. Yeah, there was kind of a kingdom of instruments and toys and things that, just by the nature of being in the room and within eyesight, we're sort of suggesting, hey, can I join? like the sitar in the corner was like, I might have something, you know, to say over here. So there was kind of a shift in the sound of the record or the music that we had been working on from that point on, the kind of, what did you say, museum, you know, the sound of the museum sort of imparted itself on the other tunes as well.
We just heard the second track, Sound Walk, from Pino Palladino, Blake Mills, Notes with Attachments. I believe the only time I hear you, Pino, walking some bass lines towards the very end, showing your jazz roots. We appreciate that. In the construction of these pieces, right, I feel like there's probably a logical flow to this where Pino might send you a melodic idea on his bass, and then you just start to orchestrate the F out of it?
You know, it was a really case-by-case situation, because over the course of maybe 20 years, I believe it was, Pino, you were compiling these different ideas, and sometimes it would be a sketch, and sometimes it was just something in your head that you'd been sort of carrying around. But other times there would be a track that emanated out of a night that Pino and Chris Stave were working at one of their home studios, you know, 5-10 years ago. There were these different ideas as we started to sort of mine the musical diary that was there for things to comprise this record, because I think it was unsaid but just tacitly understood between the two of us that the primary compositional personality on this record needed to be Pino, you know, and stem from the way that he writes and builds ideas. And sometimes, as I learned, sometimes that's from a bass line or a drum beat, and other times it could be a melody and a chord progression. Sometimes we would flush out the arrangement of the song and kind of figure out a chord change or a new section before even touching the recording, you know, and we'd just be sitting around with a couple of instruments. Mm-hmm. There were examples of the absolute opposite where we were just working on a session, you know, a multi-track session that was, you know, maybe more or less a demo of an idea or a loop, and just building an arrangement from what had already been recorded before putting anything else new on top of it.
Well, let's listen to you guys definitely Americanizing some Afrobeat here with Écouté. I don't think anything gives me more joy than hearing Chris Stave play Afrobeat. Especially like slowed down that immensely.
Totally. Well, you know what? I did a gig in London, the only gig I've ever done under my own name, actually, with Chris playing drums and James Poyser and Tim Stewart and a host of brilliant guests. It was just a one-off gig. But we did a fair bit of Afrobeat. And one of the tunes we did was Water, Vela Kuti, amazing tune. And we really slowed it down. We just had so much fun slowing it down. And so that struck a chord with me. And I always thought it'd be so cool to do, you know, a slow Afro beat. There is something really cool about that. It's just the syncopations and just the way it swings at that tempo.
Blake, before John Legend, you must have been familiar with Pino's work and his playing and his sound. What were sort of the defining moments in Pino's discography that you heard? I mean, Pino, you have a sound. How many artists have a sound? I'm curious from Blake Mills' perspective, like what were the solos that he heard first that really inspired him?
You know, to build upon what you're saying, I think it's doubly extraordinary to consider the fact that Pino sort of defined a bass sound twice. You know, there was
the new wave stuff with Gary Numan,
right?
And then D'Angelo with Voodoo,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about this sort of duality too a little bit later, but I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
I almost hear it as like the overstated and the understated.
Well, what it is, it represents somebody's musicality as being sympathetic to what else is there. Playing off of somebody else's ideas and collaboration. And being a conversationalist on your instrument rather than just a virtuoso. Being able to participate, you know, in the musical conversation and add something to it and support other people and the way that they play. I mean, that I think is the high art form of being a musician. To go back to your question, my awareness of Pino's playing and sound was primarily wrapped up in Act Two with the D'Angelo, Voodoo, and Black Messiah records. But his reputation for what he could do in a session preceded him too, you know, amongst producers and session players. I knew that I wanted to work with a live rhythm section on the John Legend record. The theme of that whole process, from my perspective, being involved in pop music, which is unusual for me, was to try to reinvent it in certain ways for myself, you know, and for John. What can you buy with the ultimate sacrifice? Treating it like a performance rather than a thing that you build in the box, like most pop songs seem to be or sound like. So Pino and Chris were kind of this well-known force amongst the record-making world, I guess you'd call it. And it was the perfect opportunity and my first opportunity to get a chance to work with them.
Pino, I want to know, just holistic speaking with your career, you know, when you knew that you had a sound that everybody wanted.
I mean, the first time it dawned on me was after working with Gary Numan. Gary gave me an opportunity to play on his album, and he particularly wanted fretless bass. You know, that was the brief for the album. My friend Chris Slade, the drummer, a Welsh guy, phoned me up and said, have you got a fretless bass? My answer was yes. He said, well, bring it over to the studio. Gary's looking for a fretless player. So I literally just turned up at Rock City Studios in Shepperton in southwest London with my Music Man fretless, which I purchased in New York about 2 months earlier. And Gary just played me the stuff, which was very early stages of the material, and just said, just do your thing on it. If you can come up with some, you know, whatever you want to come up with on this.
Thank you.
in hindsight, I pretty much turned that Gary Numan album, My Assassin, into my solo, you know, solo bass record. It was bass all over it, sometimes double track fretless. You know, I got time to come up with lines and work on the sound. I think the engineer put the fretless bass through an Eventide harmonizer and some compression, and it was a sound. I really had a good time with the sound. It was fun playing with it in the studio. And that record being released, there were a few singles on the record. One of the guys that he did was the producer Paul Young, a great British singer back in the 80s. And I went on to work with Paul, and they were looking for that fretless sound that I had used with Gary Numan. So it was around that time, I guess, you know, when Paul brought the first album out that featured me. His first album was called No Parley, and it featured me on fretless bass on quite a few of the tracks. The bass was loud in the mix. The music was mixed in a way that it allowed space for the vocal and the fretless bass to interplay. And then I guess once that album was out and I started getting reactions to my playing on it, and we started getting reactions to how much people liked the album, it dawned on me that there was something going on.
We're going to talk about Chris Dave a little bit more too, because I feel like I've had conversations with other drummers all over the world about Chris Dave. And sometimes in my own brain workings, I keep thinking, maybe too bold for thinking this, but then I always come back to it. It's like, is Chris Dave's influence really as powerful as Tony Williams or something, but we just don't know it yet?
Yeah.
I think it probably is, yeah. I think the way that the music travels now so quickly and so easy to see footage of someone playing and to get into the way they play and the way they look when they play and the different instruments they use to create what they create. Back in the days of Tony Williams, there was very few opportunities to see someone like him in person playing on a drum kit and seeing how he did it and identifying with his whole style, you know. But I think Chris probably could well have as much of an impact over time, yes.
Yeah. I think the mistake people make when it comes to Chris Dave is thinking that they have him figured out, that they know what it is that he does.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I think you actually display that kind of idea on your track called Chris Dave, because it's also not the sort of draggy rhythm that I associate the Chris Dave movement with.
Yeah. And that feel that you're talking about, the sort of, you know, the behind the beat swagger, that kind of feel thing, that's only a real small portion of Chris Dave's, you know, personality as a drummer.
So what's happening on this track that, if you can illuminate us and these other dimensions of Chris Dave?
Yeah, so that was just a groove that me and Chris came up with at my home in London. I don't even remember how it started. I just remember hearing that beat and coming up with a bass line and then putting some single note guitar stuff on it and just trying to make something unique, you know, which is not difficult with Chris because all his beats are fresh and he's capable of, you know, of just coming up with something on the spot at any given time. He's definitely plugged into some sort of creative, you know, force. I don't really understand what it is, but he always comes up with the goods.
I want to take you to another part of the record. How do I say this?
Jerkle.
Jerkle. Going back to Africa, a different region of Africa, I presume, maybe some desert blues in Mali that I hear, but about three quarters in on that tune, the release occurs, and I want to be dancing out of my seat but it's like some, again, some broken beat, dragging Afrobeat. And I'm just going to ask you, have you ever tried to dance to dragging Afrobeat? Is this kind of an awkward experience?
Oh, every day. Me and Blake practice every day, at least a few times a week.
Yeah. You know, we just make eye contact, lock eyes, and start moving. I mean, you know what? To be honest, I'm not a big mover when it comes to music. But the only music that does make me involuntarily want to move is typically music from other countries, you know, whether it's South American, Latin American, African.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff does just have a direct sort of like, you know, I'm thinking at times when I'm at like friends' weddings or something in the past and everybody's dancing and to whatever, I can't get into it. I gotta look up the YouTube, you know, how to dance at weddings for idiots video.
Oh, me too. I'm a famous non-dancer.
Well, we know how the sausage is made, so maybe that's why we can't get high on our own product.
But we're pleased that it makes you want to dance.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's, and the music is just flying. I love this quote that you had on your release, Blake, where you said, both of you are musically drawn to some kind of exception to the rule. I mean, this record honestly reminds me of like what I would experience on a Flying Lotus record, which I feel like Flying Lotus is always an exception to the rule in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
Choose a track from this record, break that idea down to us layer by layer, like what you mean, trying to be the exception and taking a right turn when everyone thinks you should go left.
On Man from Molise, the way that song originally was conceived by Pino was as a pretty fast-paced, almost Afro-Cuban jazz piece in 7/8. When he played it for me like that, it already had something very unique about it. I don't know if I've ever heard a Cuban piece in 7. I think in that sense, we think alike. I mean, we've heard a lot of music before and been involved in a lot of music. It's naturally going to be enticing when somebody comes with something that's a little left of center. The first idea that I had was to slow it down. I just wanted to hear what the song sounded like if it was at half speed. This was more like, what does this stuff sound like?
As a ballad.
Yeah, kinda. I mean, what it ended up doing was, when you just slow something down and play it back at half speed, whether it's like on a turntable and it's at the wrong setting, it also drops the pitch down an octave. Everything from the melody to the bass to the drums, all of that stuff changes its timbre radically. All of the transients and the sound of the percussion, instead of a hi-hat or a snare drum or a shaker, having kind of a quick, it's in and then it's out, you know, like a quick, real short duration of time. Everything gets spread across twice as much time. So you get this almost inebriated sluggishness. It was like Tom Waits playing an Afro-Cuban song in 7/4 all of a sudden, and I'd never heard anything like that. We're just like, wow, this is a completely different approach. It's not like there was a diagram for how you make that music.
Thank you guys so much for joining us. Congratulations on the record.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, man.
And that was The Checkout, Simon Rentner with Blake Mills and Pino Palladino. A really, really cool conversation about a couple of musicians who we admire quite a bit. And the way that they found a new lane together, Greg, what do you think about that?
Oh, man. It's the team approach. There's no I in team, that the hackneyed adage says. It's true, man. There are a lot of beautiful landscapes on this recording that really set an incredible mood and just show the imagination that is prevalent in the production of Blake Mills. I got a chance to see him work up close. And this guy is one of the greats of our time. And Pino, well, man, you know, you feel him every time you hear him. So this is like a match made in heaven, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you know, I had to ask, before we sign off here, as a bassist, man, where does Pino stand in your pantheon?
Oh, man, he's the ultimate quarterback. He's the ultimate quarterback. You can always depend on him. He's looking for the wide receivers. You know, he may run it into the end zone himself. He can. But yeah. but so many options with him, man. So many options. I love him.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed that conversation. I thought Simon, he shares our enthusiasm, and you can hear that. Mm-hmm. So thank you to The Checkout for letting us import some wisdom there. And before we go, we want to toss to our recurring segment, This I Dig, where Greg and I share current enthusiasms and endorsements. And Greg, why don't you go first here?
I actually want to talk about a buddy of mine, man. This cat goes by the moniker of No Stress. He's also known as Paul Horton, and he dropped a mammoth EP about a month ago called Prelude Number 1. I like to call it Blip Hop. That's the best name I can think of what this thing is. It's as much influenced by J Dilla as it is Andrew Hill. It's the shifting textures, many of them under 2.5 minutes long. I think the whole presentation is about 19 minutes, but these collages are coming together to tell this story that is very emotionally uplifting. It's cathartic even. And I encourage folks to check it out. Again, No Stress, Prelude Number 1 on YK Records. Definitely give that a listen. It's one of my tops already for this year.
Yeah, thank you for that. So my This I Dig this week, it's pegged to the Academy Awards. As we're taping and as we're dropping this episode, we are gearing up for the Oscars. And we've talked already about, one Oscar-nominated film, United States versus Billie Holiday, and we won't spend any more time on that. But I just want to say that there's a film that has received 5 nominations in major categories, and it's a film by Shaka King called Judas and the Black Messiah. And first of all, I think this is a really compelling film with 2 incredible performances by Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield. They're both nominated. But the thing I want to call attention to is the music in this film. The two composers of record here are Craig Harris and Mark Isham, and they do some really beautiful work with the scoring. You know, and of course, these are 2 jazz musicians. But there's also a really deft and beautiful use of music in the soundtrack, including Eddie Gale and music from Ellington Mingus and Max Roach's Money Jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And in some really pivotal moments, Rahsaan Roland Kirk's Inflated Tear. And so, you know, anyone who knows this music, watching this film, you will get that spark of recognition. But it's not just like a wink. I mean, this is really thoughtfully done. So I just wanted to shout out the use of music in this incredible film. And I hope we see some love for this in the Oscar ceremony.
Right on. Well, folks, we want to let you know our next episode is already in the works. And we're putting the spotlight on Carla Bley. What a fantastic legacy she has. It's almost impossible to pick just one type of style or vibration to point. But we're going to do our best bring Carla Bley to light for the Jazz United crowd. Make sure you check us out. Get ready for that. It's coming down the pike. It's going to be a good one.
And I hope you'll take a look at our show page where we will feature the links from this show. Please subscribe. Keep up with what we're doing at Jazz United. And we love feedback as well. So hit us up on social media, hit us up on email. And we also want to note that Jazz United is produced by Sarah Kirsten. The bulk of this episode, of course, was produced by Simon Rentner of The Checkout. And our theme song is United, composed by Newark's own Wayne Shorter and recorded by Newark's own Woody Shaw. And we hope that you'll also support WBGO, which is the place from which all of this good stuff springs. We are all working together and hope that you'll be a part of that. So WBGO.org and on the air in the greater New York area and the Newark area at 88.3 FM.